Welcome to In Jest, the podcast series designed for primary care clinicians and brought to you by the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. My name is Charlie Andrews. I'm a GP and also a GP with an extended role in gastroenterology in Bath. During this series of podcasts, I interview interesting people from across the world of gastroenterology to bring you reliable, up-to-date and relevant information that you can put into practice in your own area. As usual, a quick disclaimer before we begin. The opinions and advice given in this podcast series are those of the speakers only and shouldn't replace clinical judgment or guidelines, but should really supplement your learning and understanding around the topic. Now, if you're new to the series, welcome. If you're joining us again, having listened to previous episodes, welcome back and thank you very much for joining me today. It's always really helpful to get feedback and your opinions on the series. So it'd be really helpful if you have a moment to click on the link with this episode and follow the link to the PCSG website and provide some feedback so that we can find out what you're finding useful, what you think we could be doing better, and what topics you think might be helpful to cover. Now, today, I'm going to be talking about the management of celiac disease. So we're going to be discussing various aspects of the management of celiac disease, from the gluten-free diet to nutrient deficiencies to vaccinations, follow-up. For example, does everyone need an annual follow-up? And then we're going to be talking about what to do when people are still complaining of symptoms despite adhering to a gluten-free diet. I'm delighted to be joined by Christian Kostas-Batley today. He is a dietitian based in Bradford, and he's phenomenally knowledgeable about celiac disease. He's also really knowledgeable about the interface between primary and secondary care. He runs a community-based dietetic-led celiac service, and he really understands some of the challenges in primary care as well. So he's a brilliant person to be talking about how we can best work together to make the patient journey with celiac disease as smooth as possible and to try to deliver as good a service and support to these patients as we can. Christian, could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure thing. And thanks again for having me on, Charlie. So as you mentioned, I'm a dietitian. I'm actually a gastroenterology dietitian specializing in celiac disease. So I've been working in the NHS now for about 7 years with a few different roles, but over the last 4 years, I set up our dietitian-led celiac service over at Bradford Teaching Hospitals, and I've been running it with the support of our gastroenterologists. It's actually dietitian-led, meaning that I'm kind of the main care provider for patients there, but then I also consult with our gastroenterologists whenever there's any medical problems. So it's almost like a pretty novel model, not novel way of managing celiac disease, which it already existed before, but there's few trusts that have something like this. And we've been lucky enough to, you know, collect a lot of outcomes. We've been presenting them in many different ways, getting feedback from patients, and it's been really good so far. So that's one of the main things I do, you know, with clinics, developing the service further, trying to liaise with primary care too, and that sort of thing. So I think it'll be really good to chat about that and provide as much value as possible today.
Oh, Christian, that's great. You know, this merges two of the things that I absolutely love in gastroenterology, which is celiac disease, firstly, and secondly, community services and how we can really work better together. And that's so relevant in the current healthcare landscape, where we're seeing integrated care being quite a high priority, really. So that's great. I can't wait to have a chat to you about this and hear more about your clinic, and also a bit more about how you help patients and useful advice for our primary care clinicians. So if you haven't listened to the previous episode on celiac disease, I would recommend having a listen, because I'm talking in that episode about the diagnosis of celiac disease. So that takes us up to how we make the diagnosis, so blood tests, etc. But with Christian, I'm going to go one step forward. So we're going to move from diagnosis towards treatment. So perhaps, Christian, we could continue the patient journey now. So let's say that our listeners have listened to the previous episode about making the diagnosis. What's going to now happen to our patient who's been diagnosed with celiac disease?
Yeah, sure. So essentially, I think one of the first things that should happen as soon as someone gets a diagnosis of celiac disease is that they're referred to a dietitian, because that's going to really help them. Because as we know, you know, diet's the only treatment for this condition. And actually, there's a lot of nuance with the diet. So a dietitian can really help with that. But also when you refer to a dietitian, there's different types of dietitians, like there are different types of doctors. And I think, you know, ideally with this condition, it would be great to have a dietitian with a special interest in celiac disease, at least, or a gastroenterology dietitian. But I know some services have only got like a general dietitian they can refer to. So even that, I think, is still useful. So the dietitian can go through the diet with the patient. And then I think once that referral is made, then it depends on the service, whether there's a gastroenterologist there too. And if there is, you know, if it's not like a dietitian-led service where we're kind of connected, so for example, it gets referred to me, then I'd see the patient and I just liaise with a gastroenterologist if there's any medical problems. But if not, I think it'd definitely be useful if there's not a dietitian-led service to have gastroenterologist input and dietitian input. And then really when a patient is newly diagnosed and we go through things, it's really important, you know, that in our clinics, what we'll do is, you know, we'll talk about celiac disease, explain the diagnosis so the patient really understands it from the onset, and then get a bit of an idea of baseline symptoms so then we can then track, for, you know, moving forward, knowing, right, are things improving as we go forward? And then really get really good understanding of that patient's understanding of the diet and to what degree they think they need to follow the gluten-free diet, so we can make it clear that this is permanent and make it clear also how much they need to avoid. So one of the things that I tend to say to patients is that, you know, if you imagine a slice of bread, right, normal slice of bread, you chop that in 100 slices. One of those 100 slices is enough to cause you gut damage in a day. We know this from research. So really, when we're talking about the gluten-free diet, it is about, yes, avoiding gluten-containing grains like wheat, rye, barley, and, you know, oats that are potentially contaminated. But it's also about avoiding what we call this cross-contamination, really. And this is what can be quite challenging for patients, avoiding, you know, foods that have gluten coming in contact with gluten-free foods. So I think that's essentially the starting point there. We want to really get the patient to understand what they need to do to move forward with their condition, to, you know, improve their symptoms and keep their gut healthy, essentially.
You talked there about cross-contamination and the fact that it's so important to be really strict and with the diet. It is a complete exclusion. What sort of pitfalls are there for patients? Because it's a really hard diet to follow, and you're saying to someone you need to completely cut this out of your diet. It must be very difficult. And do you go through certain sort of pitfalls with patients and try and help guide them on that?
Definitely. And I think, you know, I can't stress that enough how difficult it is. I think sometimes, you know, as clinicians, we might see it as, you know, you just got to avoid wheat, rye, barley and oats, pretty much. They're not gluten-free. But, you know, for anyone who's tried to implement this and avoid cross-contamination, it's, you know, imagine in your own house, for example, this happens to a lot of patients who, you know, they start the diet and they'll get gluten-free bread, and then they'll just put it in the same toaster as the rest of the family. Well, that would, you know, that'd be cross-contamination. So really, we can do things like getting reusable toaster bags that they can put their bread in, for example, and that protects it so they can use the same toaster. They can buy a separate toaster, but that, again, you know, it's more expensive, it takes up space. So they could just use things like a clean pan to, you know, heat up the bread, or use a grill in the oven. So there's some of these little things that can be a bit tricky for patients to understand that when they're newly diagnosed. But there's a lot of these little things, like, you know, stuff like communicating to family too. It's not just about that patient, because actually, if your family are, you know, getting double dipping into that butter, for example, and putting onto the bread and then getting some more butter, then that butter is going to get cross-contaminated too. So really, communication is key with patients and the rest of the family so that the environment is safe. It doesn't mean the whole family needs to be gluten-free, but they just need to have a conversation about how they're doing things. And, you know, sometimes patients here, this is why we have to get the balance right, because they can go over the top and develop what we call hypervigilance, where they get really afraid of gluten. And, you know, they just think they can't even, you know, be in an environment where other people are eating it. So it's getting that balance right and understanding that actually, you know, regular hand washing is important. Gluten's only a problem when you eat it. So just wash your hands. You can touch it, but just wash your hands before, you know, you touch your mouth and that sort of thing. So that, I think there's some little common pitfalls there that we can see in some different areas, and depending also on the family, the household. So sometimes these South Asian patients, for example, they might have big households of like 10 people, for example, and that can be a really big challenge. It's really important to have that conversation. And I would say, you know, that's inside the house. But, you know, when we look at things like reading food labels, that can be quite tricky for patients again, because, you know, if you just buy from the gluten-free section, it's going to be more expensive and it's going to be quite restricted, but actually they can shop outside the gluten-free section. But this is where sometimes things can be tricky. And sometimes, you know, this is something that some people don't pick up, but you get some of these statements that say may contain gluten too, which are manufacturers saying that there's a risk of contamination with that product, and that's below the ingredients. So if you're just looking at the ingredients, then you might miss that cross-contamination statement. And this is what happens with quite a few patients. So, you know, an example would be things like Walker's Crisp, for example. They used to be gluten-free, but now even if their ingredients are fine and don't have gluten, a lot of them have a cross-contamination statement below saying they're made in a factory that handles gluten. So I think there's all these little things, and the same when you eat out, you know, cross-contamination is quite challenging to avoid with restaurants potentially saying, I've got a gluten-free menu, but then they cross-contaminate in the kitchen and don't tell you. So this is why it's quite challenging. You know, you can assume all of these things, but if you do that at surface level, it becomes quite challenging to follow that diet to the right degree.
Yeah, I'm sure. And do you have any data on how good people are at following the gluten-free diet?
Yeah, so it's quite like varied data, but it's kind of between 40 and 80% more or less. And, you know, I think really that does portray the whole variety that we see. We see some people who, you know, have got really strict adherence habits forever, but we see a lot of people who really struggle with it for valid reasons. And I see this in clinical practice, you know, even when you give that level of education, this is how you do it. It's not just about giving that education, because many of these people will struggle, and especially if they struggle from a financial point of view. And that's where things like prescription play a really important role. So if there's an, you know, a lot of areas in England don't have gluten-free prescription, unfortunately. So Bradford's one of them, for example. So a lot of people really struggle to afford this, and they'll really struggle with the diet. And there's also interesting data about comparing ethnicities with Caucasian and South Asian, where South Asian, a lot of data with South Asian patients have shown that their adherence levels are lower. And we know that, you know, something like a gluten-free chapati is really hard to make. It's really, really challenging. So a lot of patients struggle with that because it's a staple in their diet too. So I think it's, and there's all these different factors like education, socioeconomic status too, and, you know, ethnicity, a lot of these different things that play a role. So a lot of patients will find a lot of challenges with this diet, definitely.
Oh, I'm sure. In terms of other aspects, so we've talked quite a bit there about diet. It's been really interesting actually hearing about the cross-contamination issues, and I'm sure eating out must be really difficult. But when you see that patient, are there other things that you're thinking about?
Absolutely. So, and, you know, more within the role I have in the dietitian-led service, so it's kind of looking at a whole overview of the patient. And really, it's looking at how, you know, I'd look at how things like symptoms fit in there with you know, where the patient's at, you know, whether it's like our first follow-up, second follow-up, that sort of thing. But we'd look at, right, are they avoiding gluten to the right degree? But then we also need to help that patient get the balance right and actually, you know, compensate for removing gluten from their diet. And I think that's really important. And I think it's often not talked about enough, because yes, we can get the patient to avoid gluten, but we also need to get them to have enough fiber, enough calcium for the bone health too. And we see that a lot of patients can get constipated when they go on a gluten-free diet because they don't consciously make an effort to increase fiber. And we know that gluten-free labeled foods, you know, the counterparts of gluten-containing foods, will have less protein, less fiber usually too. So we need to bear this in mind. And that's why our approach is usually to optimize things through naturally gluten-free foods too. And that's how we also get more calcium, more iron into the diet. So it's about getting the balance right with avoiding gluten, but optimizing health long-term. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it too, but a lot of these patients who come back with ongoing symptoms, and if it's, you know, it's functional symptoms, for example, then there's a lot we can do with diet there to help them too, beyond just removing gluten.
Yeah, you're jumping ahead there, Christian. We're not quite at follow-up yet. Our patient is still at the first stage. They've just been diagnosed. You mentioned about calcium, and I, you know, something that I as a GP sometimes struggle with is knowing when someone needs a DEXA scan, and particularly around celiac disease. So does someone need a DEXA scan at diagnosis?
Yeah, really good question. And I think I don't have a definite answer for you on that one, because the guidance, so we've got some guidance from the BSG, and there's guidance from other areas too. And a lot of them suggest looking at risk factors with these patients, probably more when patients above the age of 55, potentially. They've got, you know, if they smoke or, you know, they drink too much, potentially, if they've had significant weight loss, that sort of thing. But I think in a lot of areas, what we have is a bit of an agreement. And, you know, in Bradford, for example, we've got an agreement with our gastroenterologist that we do a DEXA scan on all adults after a year on the gluten-free diet, because that way, at least we know from baseline. I think sometimes these guidelines can be a bit conservative. And that's my concern. Having seen a lot of these DEXA scans come through, it's really hard to predict those that are going to have low bone mineral density or not. And I think if we can actually catch that earlier, then we can put something in place that can help plus adherence too. And then if things are fine, you probably don't need to worry for another like 5 to 10 years. Mm. So I think that would be my approach. I think it's a bit of like looking at the guidelines to see who's a bit higher risk, but also having that sort of agreement and having a standardized approach. I think that helps. But I can see how that could be challenging also as a GP if there's no set pathway there.
Yeah, well, that's really helpful advice. I guess another thing is we don't really know how long they've had celiac disease for as well. And sometimes they've had it for quite a long time, I guess. And
it's 13 years on average to get a diagnosis, isn't it? So some will have it for quite a while.
Yeah, so I guess, so really thinking about the DEXA. So that's really good advice. Thanks, Christian. Are there any other things that you think about aside from that? So I'm thinking of vaccinations, and I'm also thinking of kind of mood and things, because clearly this is a chronic disease, and that's got to play a part as well. So sort of practical aspects of kind of vaccinations and other bits, but also mood. How do you kind of approach all of those?
Yeah, as you said, with vaccinations, definitely, I'd always like send so we've got like a system, we use like system one, so we'd send a task to the GP, a standard task asking for a pneumococcal vaccine and, you know, a yearly flu jab too. But definitely address things like mood. And, you know, I'd always ask the patient, you know, how do you feel about this as we go? For some, it can be a really big shock. And I think what we see with a lot of these patients is that, you know, they have to absorb it. They've got to accept the diagnosis. And that's why sometimes adherence can take a bit longer, you know, to get better. But it's something that's, you know, that's why it's really important to gauge it, not just, I don't just like throw the information at the patient, because if you do that, then a lot of them can get overwhelmed. So for some of these, I think it's actually better to pitch it at their level and get them to understand that it's just making these changes. You might not get them to start the full gluten-free diet tomorrow, but it's got to be personalized to that patient. And I think that's completely key. And then in terms of a few other things there at diagnosis, I think another thing that's really important is first degree relative testing, talking about that. So we know that, you know, first degree relatives of people with celiac disease have got 10% chance of developing it. So I think that's a really good opportunity to speak to the patient and say, yeah, we thought about testing first degree relatives. And we know that's, you know, that's recommended within guidance too. And then the other thing I would also check there too is stuff like blood tests. So basically we've got a pathway with our gastroenterologist where we would do bloods at diagnosis too, so that we can know actually, you know, how are things like hematinics, you know, how's vitamin D, we want to check that too. Because a lot of these patients are quite lethargic, we want to check obviously iron levels, full blood count. So we've got a bit of an agreement, which is kind of in line with a lot of the BSG guidance, with some similar bloods there. And then we'll also check for other autoimmune conditions. So that's where we'll check for blood glucose, thyroid function, that sort of thing. Because, you know, and I'd say that's really common to see thyroid problems in people with celiac disease. I'm sure you've seen that too. But I think it's just a good starting point, really.
That's really helpful. And in the episode that I recorded before, we did talk a lot about kind of those associations with other autoimmune conditions. So yeah, really important area to think about. So moving from the sort of diagnosis stage, before we come on to follow up and those aspects, I did just want to stop and just ask a little bit about resources for patients. Now, I'm aware of Celiac UK, and I think they do some fantastic things for patients and fantastic resources. So maybe we could talk a bit more about that. But the other aspect, in our area, we've got something called patient webinars. We've got a fantastic group of community dietitians who do some online webinars for patients.
Marianne, right?
And So they're a brilliant team. They do some fantastic webinars. And if you haven't been to their website, I do recommend having a look at patient webinars. It's really good. What sort of resources would you recommend that we give to patients to try and help them as best as we can with this huge change to their life?
Yeah, good. And there's loads. And I was going to say patient webinar is definitely one, because they've got like full webinar, like a 1 hour webinar explaining celiac disease and management. And then they've got bite-sized webinars, so you can see it in small chunks, going through the diet, all that sort of thing. So absolutely, definitely recommend patient webinars, celiac disease section. What I'd say is, in line with what you're saying with celiac UK, I think, you know, one of the first things that we want to make sure is that patient is aware of celiac disease and that enjoys sleep activities. I look like I'm selling the product pretty much when I'm speaking to patients, because I just think it helps so much with the long-term management. So I think, you know, a key take home today is their gluten-free food checker app. So basically this app, you can, if you're a member, so you can join Celiac UK and get a digital membership for as little as £1.25 a month. For that £1.25 a month, you'll get access to this app for free. You can take it to the supermarket, scan a barcode, and it tells you the food is gluten-free or not, with a smiley face or a sad face. Now that makes the whole navigating food labels outside the gluten-free section a million times easier. You've got a search bar to search things from home. It comes up with product recalls, so if something stops being gluten-free, it lets you know, so it keeps you completely in the loop. And then, you know, and I think that's one of the best things that people can do. Because a lot of people start to read labels and they can get it wrong. So this helps you to make sure you're actually getting it right. And then I think the other thing, if you're a member of Celiac UK, you can download another app called Gluten Free on the Move. And this app, actually, you can search within a radius and it tells you if there's certain restaurants that are potentially accredited by Celiac UK, so they're aware of cross-contamination, they've had training for that, or highly recommended by users too. So you can search for that, and that will help you with eating out. What we were talking about before, these challenges of cross-contamination, you want to be ideally going to places that are clued up about it. It's going to make your life a million times easier. So these apps are key resources, I think. And I can't recommend them enough. So I think that would be one of the main resources, I would say. Do you want me to mention a couple of more?
Please do, Christian. It'd be great. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So the other thing I'd say is there's a couple of other things too there. So with Celiac UK, I also think that a lot of patients can really struggle. And I think as a GP, you might find it hard if like there's not a dietitian in your area to liaise with directly or if patients have questions about food labels, that sort of thing. Celiac, you've got a free helpline that a patient can call. So you can just go on the website, even if you're not a member, and there's dietitians on the helpline too. So you can get some first line advice from there for free. So I think that can be really helpful, or you can call about products or that sort of thing. I also think that there's a few other things there that, you know, some apps too, which I think, you know, for example, traveling is quite a challenge for a lot of patients. So there's some apps there. I sometimes recommend one called Gluten Free Card, which essentially says, you know, I've got a condition where I can't eat wheat, rye, barley, oats, or anything cooked with it. And you've got different buttons you can translate that into different languages. But I would say even in the UK, taking that and showing that to the server is going to make your life a lot easier. And then also, you know, in Celiac UK, you've got more than 1,000 recipes on there. And I think in this age of technology, there's actually some bloggers out there that are really good. So I recommend that to, I think it's hard to share that through the podcast, but actually there's some bloggers that are liaised with Celiac UK too, that actually, you know, have got some fantastic recipes. They talk about new products that come out in supermarkets, that sort of thing. So I think some of these digital resources can really help patients. And if a patient doesn't use digital resources, they can also get the Celiac UK, the non-digital membership, and they get food and drink directory booklets. And in the post, it tells them what foods and what supermarkets are suitable. So I think, you know, as a GP, some of these first line things would be really good to help patients get set off, I think.
I think, yeah, absolutely right. And I've used the gluten-free food checker, the app. It's amazing. It's absolutely brilliant. You know, it's really very, very clever piece of kit. So I think it's brilliant. So whenever I see a celiac, I'm always pointing them towards that sort of thing, because actually it just makes life so much easier. And when you're having this huge change to your life, anything that makes it a bit easier is really important. And I think
it works in loads of supermarkets, doesn't it? So it's fantastic.
It's brilliant. Yeah, no, it's really good. Okay, so Christian, our patient is now moving on to the follow-up phase. So they've had that initial amazing consultation with you. They know exactly what celiac disease is. You've looked at all aspects, you've done your DEXA, you know, you're supporting all aspects of their condition. And they're now sort of being let go into the community. And what happens then? Because actually, I sometimes think about the follow-up for patients with celiac disease. And I have done a little bit of research into what goes on around the country, and it's pretty variable. And you speak
to be a black hole somewhere.
It does feel a little bit like that. And actually, some patients who I've spoken to do feel a little bit abandoned in the community in some areas. And, you know, what happens when someone's discharged from your service I guess perhaps in your service they're not discharged? What does happen? Why don't you tell me a bit about what's happening in your area, Christian? Because I think it sounds fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. So what's happening in my area is that what we implemented this service, and then what we do is we keep the follow-ups for all patients. So, you know, we're in a bit of a privileged position. All the service is pretty overrun, which is one of the challenges when you just don't discharge patients. But really what we have is, I'm actually working now to, we're developing like a digital software tool where we can do annual reviews with a really thorough form for patients that are really stable for maybe a couple of years. And then on the third year, we give them a call. So that helps manage higher volumes of patients. But really that's what we do. So, you know, when the patient comes through, we keep on following them up and then just put them on for an annual review if they're stable. But what happens in a lot of services is that, you know, there isn't really adequate resources for this. And what happens in many places is that, you know, they might be into the service for something like a couple of years and then get discharged to primary care with the hope that primary care will follow up. But I think, you know, as we both know, primary care is extremely busy and, you know, a lot of places aren't funded to do it too. So then that annual review might end up not happening for that patient. And then that's where they kind of go into this black hole. And then it's down to the patient really to decide what they want to do. If they want to take that forward or they've got symptoms or that sort of thing.
Do you think all patients need an annual follow-up?
So I think in terms of checking that things are good, I think, and that's why I think we can do these things like digital form for those that are really stable, where we probably just need to check their bloods as per guidance. And that's, you know, and that's it really, because if they're following the diet, nothing's changed, that's fine. But really, I think that a lot of patients do benefit from that follow-up, and at least for a few more years, I think, you know, it's a really hard position, because I think ideally, yes, let's follow up everyone, but I know it's not really realistic in many areas. But I do think that a lot of these patients that, you know, we keep following up, you know, a lot of them come back with recurring symptoms. And if we discharge them, God knows what would have happened to them. And actually, some of them can come back and it might be like refractory celiac disease, or they might have functional issues, or they might just stop following the diet because they really struggle and they've had no support. So I think when we discharge these patients, we kind of assume that things are going well. And I don't think that's the case, which is why I think that follow-up is important for patients, especially during the first, I'd say probably at least the first 5 years, something like that. But yeah, fully appreciate it. The resources aren't really there in many places to do that.
It's really challenging. I think it's great what you've got in Bradford. I think you've got a great service there. And I agree. I think it is really important to follow up patients with celiac disease. You know, it is a life-changing condition, really, at the end of the day. And I do think that, you know, from my experience of following up patients with celiac in GP, you do pick up people who are deficient in various things and who actually would benefit from further support. And so I do think I think there is a lot of value in it.
Definitely. And I think, you know, just quickly you mentioned on that. So I think what I see with a lot of these patients is that they don't have much follow-up, right? But they don't have follow-up from a dietitian point of view, which leaves them self-managing with their diet. And then what happens is when they have ongoing symptoms, they just think, well, you know, I just need to cut out more food from my diet. And they do this on their own. And that takes them down a huge rabbit hole of over-restricting, not getting anywhere. Whereas really we have that follow-up, say with a dietitian and gastroenterologist, GP, then quickly we can nip that in the bud and then sort it out really quickly. So I think definitely when we leave these people to manage it on their own, it creates more problems further down the line.
And what do you do at that follow-up appointment? What do you feel that should be done there at that review?
Yeah, so I think at that follow-up appointment, definitely really important to just check things like, you know, is everything stable from a weight point of view? How are the symptoms doing? That's great. If all of that's good. And I think it's also really important to have a check-in with adherence there, really. And that's why, you know, that's where as dietitians, we can check and say, actually, is this patient still following the diet? Because what happens is that, you know this from research, where patients can often say, yes, I'm following the diet if you ask them. But then we break this down into all these things with cross-contamination, they might be missing things. So it gives them an opportunity to improve that. And then also in these annual reviews, you say, well, actually, you know, as you were talking about things like mood, how are you doing? Are you finding this diet too burdensome? You know, are you shopping outside the gluten-free section? I ask these my patients a lot, because if they're not, we know they're probably over-restricting their diet. So it's getting the balance right, you know, from a psychological point of view. And then it's really looking at these things. If they're identifying gluten properly, let's get them to maximize the diet, improve digestive health, get more fiber in there, calcium, iron, all this sort of thing, whilst also checking, you know, for stuff like DEXA bone scan. So yes, we've done one. Do we need a follow-up DEXA bone scan? You know, where the osteoporotic, do we need to check it? Is it due? So it's all these sorts of things to make sure that the patient is well managed from a celiac disease, but, you know, with regards to their other health too.
And what blood tests would you do at that review?
So we've got an agreement with our gastroenterologist where we do most of the ones from the BSG. So we would check things like full blood counts, we check ferritin, B12, folate, vitamin D, we check bone profile too, and UNE. And then depending on what's going on with the patient, and you know, the TTG too is a bit variable, so it kind of depends on the assessment too. So if I assess that patient and they're not eating, you know, they're eating gluten, there's not much point in doing the TTG there. So that's where we can save some of these things from happening. But otherwise, yeah, we'd probably check a TTG just to make sure everything's in range. And then what we would do with that patient is, the other bloods. So sometimes we would check for some other bloods if we're, you know, if we're suspicious about some other conditions, might do another thyroid check, or we might check blood glucose, that sort of thing too.
Okay. And how reliable is the TTG at follow-up?
I love that you've asked that question. So definitely, and this is why I think it's really important to have a dietitian reviewing these patients for adherence, because actually, you know, we had this great systematic review from 2017 that showed that, you know, when they compared TTG results with a repeat biopsy, these TTGs had a sensitivity of less than 50%. So really not that accurate. I see this in practice where I see a patient and say, oh, my TTG's been fine every year, and they're eating like a slice of bread a day. I'm like, that's because the TTG is not always accurate. So I think that's why it's really important to see, you know, when patients come back with symptoms, if they've got a negative TTG, it doesn't mean that A, they're not eating gluten, and it doesn't mean that, you know, they don't have active celiac disease. Mm. We need to take that with a pinch of salt. And I think with celiac disease, we always need to look at the full picture. Symptoms, diet, other bloods to what the patient's reporting, that sort of thing.
If we're in an area where we don't have your fantastic service, which patients do you think we should refer to a dietitian if we're seeing them opportunistically in primary care?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I think definitely those who are newly diagnosed, 100%, really important to catch these patients. I think that patients that are struggling, so if you see they come to your clinic and, you know, they say, I'm not following the diet, I'm really struggling, definitely these patients can benefit from it, because a dietitian can break things down and make it easier. And I think there's probably also benefit for those patients who come back with ongoing symptoms, because I think as dieticians, this isn't like clearly documented in the guidance, but through my work in the clinic, there's a lot we can do there, because actually, if they're eating gluten without knowing it, we can help them there. If they've got IBS type symptoms, we can also help them there, and functional symptoms, there's a few things we can do there. So I think I'd say probably those three scenarios are the probably highest priority ones.
And are there any scenarios where you think it's more appropriate for us to refer to the gastroenterologist than to you?
Yeah, definitely. So I think those with ongoing symptoms, definitely a referral to gastroenterologist is really important. And it might be some of these patients too, if, you know, for example, I've seen this with some patients with celiac disease. They come back with a recurrent anemia, right? And sometimes this can happen where the anemia is caused by something else and it's not the celiac disease, and you've got a negative TTG there and you're not sure what to do. So I think some of these might be good, because actually what we might need is a repeat biopsy to double check, is there active celiac disease there or not? So I think when there's challenges there with the blood, or challenges again with these symptoms, which we can't add up, I think it makes sense there to send it. And it depends, you know, if there's a dietitian or not linked to that, but I think some of these more medical problems definitely make sense to refer to a gastroenterologist.
So it sounds like it's sort of you have to assess that patient and really think about all of these things and think, is it diet, but actually have a really open mind as well to actually, could it be something else? Because you can easily, well, you can certainly have other conditions alongside celiac disease, can't you?
We see stuff a lot of times, you know, sometimes stuff like the fecal calprotectin might help, that sort of things. It's a bit, you know, it depends, but we see that with a lot of patients, you know, there's all these associations, microscopic colitis, can be bile acid diarrhea too, you know, SIBO, all these sorts of things. So it's just quite tricky, isn't it, to know exactly what's going on with the patient.
Yeah, no, completely agree. We're coming to the end of the podcast, and it's been fantastic to go through that patient journey. So just to finish off, Christian, top tips or key messages that you'd like your audience to take home from this talk? There are so many useful things you've talked about. It's quite hard even to pick something out that's been particularly useful. But from your point of view, what do you think are the key messages in management of celiac disease for our audience?
Sure. I definitely think it's much more complex than people think. Even, you know, even me as a dietitian coming into it, I thought, you know, when I started to get involved with celiac disease, I thought this is probably pretty straightforward. You just tell them to avoid gluten and that's it. It's the opposite. So I think really understanding that, actually involving other professionals, skilled dietitians, is a really important part of getting this patient better. And I think the other thing too is what we talked about, you know, so yes, this diet is complex getting that support, but once we get that support, that follow-up is also really important. And I think it's important to not just assume that if we just start someone on a gluten-free diet, off they go, they get better, we don't need to see them again. That's definitely not the case. So I think the follow-up aspect is really important because as we've both seen, you know, a lot of these patients come back with ongoing symptoms that we need to get to the bottom of to get them better.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Christian. I've learned loads from talking to you and it's been really interesting and really, it's been very stimulating and motivating because I can tell how interested you are in celiac disease and the fact that you're really driven with your clinic. It sounds like you're doing amazing things up there. So keep it going. I look forward to having a chat to you again. I'm sure we'll be able to have another discussion about celiac disease on the podcast. There's so much more I'd like to ask you. So thanks for joining me today.
Definitely. I've really enjoyed that. Thanks again for having me. I see that energy coming from you too, and I love interacting with people in this way. So thank you.
Great. Thanks, Christian.